Founding Band here, also in the Dynamics cluster at Compass, and I work on diaspora and conflict issues. I'm never sure what my discipline is, which is probably why I've been asked to chair today, and my job is to try to keep to time my colleagues with their brief responses from their particular disciplinary backgrounds to this question of why do people migrate, which we're kicking off the course with. So let me open up by inviting Carlos to get the ball rolling on economics.
Carlos Vargas Silva, I am an economist. I work in Compass, in the Migration Observatory of Compass. I'm going to tell you more about that later on. I have an interest on labor markets and migration. So from the economics perspective, people act and they behave in such a way to maximize their well-being. So if they have two choices and they choose one, it's because their well-being is higher under that choice. So that means that the question, why do people migrate, is very simple in economic terms. People migrate because they're better off in the other place, like in the place they were before. Living is better than staying. That's the end of the story. Now, the complex question is what makes people being better off in one place than in another? And the reason for that is that well-being is affected by many variables. Now, this is a very complex question, and the way economists analyze this question is by using the marginal approach, which means they're going to embrace complexity. They're going to try to account for all factors that may affect their well-being, and they are going to try to change one factor at a time. For instance, they take two individuals, which are very similar, and they try to change one factor. Let's say one individual is older than the other one. And by doing that, by analyzing the behavior of those two individuals, which are supposed to be very similar, with one difference, then they can see what is the impact, for instance, of age on the probability of migrating. The other point I want to make is in economics, when we have this theory and we see the impacts of different variables on your well-being and your decision to migrate, we test these possibilities and hypotheses using advanced statistical techniques. And this is an advantage in a case in a, or a discipline such as a migration, in which you have a lot of controversy about the findings. So the thing, when you have advanced statistical techniques, anyone can replicate the analysis. So they can take your data, they can do it, and they can come up with their own conclusions. So this transparency of economics is very useful. So these are some of the things I'm going to be talking to you in the classes.
Okay, thanks, Carl. So good start. It's simple and it's complex. So now Bridget will make it even more complex.
Hi, I'm Bridget Anderson. I'm sorry I'm not going to be there tomorrow. And I head up the Compass cluster and research on citizenship and belonging.
Well, I start off by saying where I think economics differs from many of the other disciplinary perspectives is that it isn't particularly interested in subject making. It's interested in measuring and it's interested in counting migrants and associated variables, but it's not actually focused on who asking who counts as a migrant. And I think that's something that maybe the other disciplines are more engaged with. So in order to answer the question, why do people migrate, I would have to ask a whole lot of other questions. When is mobility treated as migration and why? Why do we have to explain migration at all? Why don't we rather have to explain staying put? Good example, the marriage migration of women to South Korea, to peasant areas of South Korea. It's received a lot of attention. But why are the guys there not moving? That's also a question, but we seem to be focused on mobility. So why do we have to explain migration? Also, this sounds like, why do people migrate? It sounds like a question about individual choice, but it's also a question about history and state construction and inequality and law. We can hear from that last point that we're foregrounding questions about structure, agency, force, and subjectivity, which actually, I would argue, underpin many of our understandings about migration, and in particular, the distinction between the refugee and the economic migrant. The refugee used to be imagined as a liberal political actor involved in liberal politics, fleeing communist persecution. And this model, of course, no longer holds, which is a problem for the way that refugees are contemporaneously imagined. They're not ballet dancers and professors anymore. But anyway, ideas of force and coercion are one set of reasons provided for why people migrate. Then there are the economic migrants, as Carlos outlined, who are imagined as liberal sovereign selves, making rational decisions, autonomous and independent, people who choose to migrate. But let's remember, choice is a tricky term. The more constrained your options, the more enthusiastically you will embrace difficult conditions. And the collapse of these two categories, the economic migrant and the refugee, is also manifest in the rise of the victim of trafficking, a figure that brings together ideas of force and coercion and economic desperation, and a figure that enables liberal states to demonstrate their recognition of the human rights of non-citizens that are protected by preventing them from entry. And I just end by saying that this framing, the economic migrant, the victim of trafficking, the refugee, leaves out actually a whole load of people, most obviously students, but also religious migrants, backpackers, and lots of other important groups.
Thank you, Bridget. Frank, next.
All right, I'm Frank Duvet, senior researcher. I'm in the Dynamics of Migration cluster, working on irregular migration networks, national, international politics, and I'm also running the Turkish Migration Studies Group. Well, I'd say, or I would like to remind, that 50, 60 years ago, there were very few, mostly naturalistic, demographic, economistic migration theories. There was Ravenstein's flow theory, Thornthwaite's pressure, he was a climatologist, or Lee's push and pull factor model, quite infamous, and a very small set of ordering migration typologies. Currently, there are at least six classical and neoclassical and at least 10 or more modern alternative migration theories and theorems, and at least 50 or more sort of ordering migration typologies. And this is only to illustrate that we now have a much better understanding of why migration occurs and why people migrate, of all these grand economic, social, political, cultural determinants, but also of the detailed opportunity and constraints structures, and constraints are often left out, and of some of the individual characteristics and other factors that influence individual decision making. For example, migration system theory explains the flow of people between specific locations and countries. Migration network theory explains the social structure and the resources available within these, and how this then facilitate migration and social behavior. And social and human capital theory and also human agency theory explain how individual resources influence then decision-making and migration behavior. So all this we have a grasp, but most of these explanations are actually retrospectively explaining migration, and they almost fail to predict or to forecast individual behavior or the magnitude of flows. So, and all these theories often fail to explain why migration, as Bridget said, does not occur, or why two people in almost the same situation and with the same characteristics, one is migrating, the other one is not. So migration research, I would argue, is characterized by a major bias, which is already inherent to the research subject, which is migration. We don't study non-migration. And the research question, we study why do people migrate. We don't ask or study why do people not migrate. For example, there are currently, and I haven't got the latest figures, maybe 800 million people suffering from starvation. 2 billion people at least live in poverty. But according to the latest Gallup Global Migration Survey, only 600 million people aspire to migrate, whilst indeed we only have 200 million international migrants. So the majority of the global population is relatively immobile. Indeed, probably the level of population mobility was greater in history than it is now. So for me, the greatest puzzle increasingly sort of is becoming why people do not want to migrate, why they cannot migrate, or why they do not migrate. Why do people not migrate even if there are huge income differentials, even if there are networks, even if there are no restrictions to migration, as within Europe, where we have a very low level of mobility and migration? So in my view, the question why people do not migrate is the test question for any of the theories and other theories I've mentioned. And because no theory can really answer the question. They all fall short of ultimately understanding human geographic mobility. Maybe to provoke some debate, I believe that economic theories, at least sort of the sort of old-style, old-fashioned, classical, neoclassical, are particular nonsense in explaining migration. Though that's why I want to provoke some debate here. Though otherwise, they are certainly very essential to understand the economic impacts of migration, the labor market aspects, the whole skills debate, and so on. So there is still a significant value of these theories, but there is also significant weaknesses. But that applies to other theories as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. I'll move to Meta.
Yes. Why do people migrate? As an anthropologist, I don't think this is an answer I can answer in, or a question I can answer in the abstract. So, like Bridget, I would also need to ask, firstly, whose mobility counts as migration and when? And to Carlos, I would say that often people migrate for a range of reasons, which may include material aspirations, hopes of a better life for their children, or to be closer to relatives, to escape from poverty, repression, or instability, but also out of serendipity or for adventure, to study, for marriage, or because people believe they would be better off somewhere else doesn't mean that they actually will be. So it's not always possible to pin down one reason, and also rationales and plans and hopes change over time, as we all know from our own lives. So I would treat the question as an empirical question that would require long-term ethnographic fieldwork, including migrants, aspiring migrants, and their kin, to be able to answer it. Also, I would say we need to appreciate and to acknowledge that the same person may give different reasons for migrating, depending on when they're asked and by whom, and we need to look at practices as well as rhetoric about migration. So it's not enough just to, it's not such a simple answer, a simple question to actually ask people. We also need to remember that migration is embedded in relations of power between regions and states, between urban and rural areas, between migrants, non-migrants, and aspiring migrants, and between individuals within families and households. So we would need to situate our answer to the question within a wider historical context, including also colonialism and empire, the global political economy, and the weight of inequality on the individuals and groups. So migration is complex and controversial, as Carlos says, and scholars should aim to add nuance and historical depth to our understanding of migration, I would say, rather than to simplify it.
Okay, thanks, Meta. Catherine, give a legal perspective.
Yeah, thank you very much. Hi, my name is Catherine Costello. I'm a member of the law faculty here, and I teach the law element of this paper, and I have a Compass affiliation as well. So my opening answer, and I was tempted to stop here, was to say that traditional legal scholarship just can't and shouldn't answer this question, why do people migrate? Because lawyers don't study human behaviour. We study, at least traditional legal scholars, study rules, concepts, principles, legal institutions, and then depending on your approach to legal scholarship, you may just leave it at that, which sometimes we refer to as black letter law, or, and depending on where you study law, really, it's a cultural phenomenon, that might be just it. You know, there's plenty of rules to try to figure out. So in that way, we lawyers often, you know, should just be quite modest about what they know about and say, well, we don't know how the law really works or has an impact on human behaviour or whether it does or not. And I could stop there, but. but of course, there are other ways of doing legal scholarship, and that would be more law in context or law and approaches, which would try to engage with other social sciences and try to understand how the law actually works and what sorts of impacts it has. But I think to do that well, you need to be, or at least good law and context scholarship needs to be clear about its kind of methodology and the sort of empirical methods it's using. Lawyers also, and legal scholarship also strays into the normative very often. I think it makes claims about what laws would be more just, or what is a more just position. But I think to do that, then you have to be explicit about that you're doing political philosophy or meta-ethics or ethics, and make the normative discourse sort of explicit as well. So when I was reflecting on this, I mean, I think, you know, the best law and context work is often by those from other disciplines. So a book that I was looking at lately, a famous book called Why People Obey the Law by Tom Tyler. I mean, he's actually a psychologist by training. He does very methodologically sophisticated work about human behavior and testing other variables. His title is now actually the Professor of Law and Psychology at Yale. But having said that, I don't want to surrender law to other social science disciplines, because I think every question that we address when we look at migration is one that invokes legal concepts. So that even the very first one about what is international migration posits the existence of a border between states, and whether there are two separate states in any given geographical area, I would say, is predominantly a legal question. It might also have historical and geographical dimensions, but you know, the border is a legal concept. Similarly, we might imagine just questions like, and whether we see, I mean, and right there, when we think about international migration, there's an asymmetry, because we assume that it's illegitimate and in fact unlawful for states to prevent their own citizens leaving, but that it's normally okay for states to prevent people entering the territory of a state that is not their own, with the possible exception of refugees, but even that's contested. And that's actually built into the state system, and it's reflected in international law, and we sort of take that for granted. So in very foundational level, there are sort of legal principles and concepts that we can't ignore. And straight away I've said citizen, refugee, immigrant, all of which are legal concepts and categories, partly defined by international law, partly defined by national law. The questions of how international and national law inform one another are all legal questions that are not amenable to simple answers, and the answers to which will vary across different states at different times and are highly contested. And that's before I even get into the question about, well, okay, so we've set up an international system which posits that states have a large role in regulating at least certain types of migration. And that's before I've even gotten into, I suppose, what are more political questions about, well, what informs states and governments' decisions about how to regulate migration if they choose to do so. And there, I guess, what we see is policies informed by very scanty assumptions very often. And there is kind of, I guess, scholarship in areas like criminology or in, you know, law and disciplines which try to understand how those policies, at least to test some of those policy assumptions, like I guess the pull factors thesis is actually really popular in practice, saying, well, if we treat migrants in certain ways, or particularly asylum seekers, say, in certain ways, this may or may not deter them in coming. But I guess what I would say, just to conclude, is that really I think sometimes, so I'm quite open to saying law needs the social sciences if we're to understand anything about human behaviour. It may need the humanities too, and there's a lot of law and humanities scholarship also. But to be a bit more provocative, I would say sometimes social scientists make very naive assumptions about the law, about how clear, how stable, how static it is, and how and think of the law as, you know, just very clear rules that are somehow sort of posited and almost enforced themselves, whereas actually legal concepts are very open textured, and how they work in practice is something that should also be the subject, I think, of study by anthropologists, economists, and social scientists. And particularly, just maybe to echo Bridget's point about, you know, what we see as migration is often determined by law. So the movement of EU citizens within the EU, I mean, the EU institutions would certainly prefer if we didn't even call that migration. I mean, they like to think that that's a different kind of mobility. And so, you know, there, all of that, I think, is, there are just legal principles, concepts, rules at work at different levels, interacting in unusual ways in this field. So I would say perhaps a more nuanced understanding of law is an important addition, or sort of a key requirement, really, for social scientists and for those doing migration study.
Thank you, Catherine.
Hi, I'm Sarah Spencer. I've got a particular interest in public policy dimensions of migration and in irregular migration, and I teach one session towards the end of this paper on public policy and particularly on the use of research in the public policy-making process. So what do public policymakers in destination countries make of all this? How do they use our collective knowledge of the complexity of migrants' motivations? I would say, perhaps provocatively, but in a word, badly. And I'll just give three examples. First of all, they don't really accept the legitimacy of migrants having mixed motives for moving. They see people either as a labour migrant or as an asylum seeker or as an international student or a family migrant. And first of all, in entry, those are the labels under which you enter. And you don't really get any brownie points or any bonus points for instance, being a family migrant who also wants to work. The Canadian system is one exception to that, but on the whole, you have to be one thing or another. And worse than that, there's actually downright suspicion of someone who actually wants to do something. So if you're an asylum seeker and you actually want to work, just don't mention it. Or increasingly, if you're an international student who wants to work, then there is a suspicion in the policy-making process that actually you said you're coming for one thing, but you really want to do another. So their perception of motives doesn't match the reality of the complex reasons why people do move, and the fact that to come through a particular entry channel, you've channeled yourself into that, despite the fact that actually you've got some other motives as well. Secondly, I'd say they overestimate the importance of migrants' motives relative to the sort of structural factors which set the context in which migrants do make their choices. So to give an example, the factors that create the demand for migrant labour, on which Bridget has done so much work. If policymakers actually really want to manage that whole labour migration process well, they might do better to focus on addressing all those many reasons why there's such a demand for skilled and unskilled labour. Paid care workers more, for instance, so we don't need to import so many from abroad. Train more engineers, so we don't need so many skilled engineers. They might do better to be looking at that rather than trying to look at ways of discouraging the supply of migrants, which is on which they tend to focus. And my third example would be that they tend to misconstrue the motives of migrants when the facts don't actually fit their preconceptions of why people want to come. So to give an example, European policymakers in the mid-1990s and 2000s were absolutely convinced that record numbers of asylum seekers were, in their terms, choosing European destinations because of our systems of far too generous benefits and access to work. So having made that assumption, the answer to managing asylum more effectively was to cut off access to work and benefits. And no matter that the research actually found that that wasn't why, well, first of all, many people were not choosing where they went in the first place, but that those who did had actually very different motivations from the ones that policymakers were assuming. So why do policymakers often get it wrong and often ignore the evidence we provide or misuse it? Well, that's what my lecture will cover when we get there.
Thanks, Sarah, and thanks to all the panel for your contribution. So we've heard a range of approaches to this question, why do people migrate, from a range of disciplinary perspectives, though I note that several of my colleagues have sort of either sidestepped the question or in true academic fashion asked a load of new questions on top of the original question. But perhaps what people have said underscores is the idea that most, if not all, migration has mixed motivation. There's often a mix of compulsion and choice involved in migration. And you will maybe have already come across this notion of a continuum between so-called forced migration and so-called voluntary migration. And I just noticed, incidentally, looking through your bios, that many of you have experience of refugee or related questions or have an interest in forced migration. So that's an interesting angle, I think. Also, as we have heard, motivations to migrate can change en route. So someone who's left a country because of conflict, for example, once a modicum of safety is secured in a different location, then their motivation turns to their livelihood issues for them and their family. So sort of more economic issues come to the fore. So in a sense, it's true what governments say, that refugees can become economic migrants, in a sense. And then if we turn our focus from the level of the individual to the level of the household, we find that members of a single family or a single household may well have different reasons for migrating. It might be safety, it might be livelihood, it might be education, it might be marriage, and so on. And also, as we've heard, all of these different mixes of motivations are set within broader structures of power and so on.